This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Common misconception that after a rest one has regained strength. I think we find that after a rest it takes a long time to recover. And that's why, you remember, we often talked about the fact that when Rabbi Akiva came home to Rachel, his wife, after his 12 years of learning, and he overheard her say, you know, if he wants to go for another 12 years, it's also alright. So he went. And Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitzer used to ask, why didn't he go and say good afternoon? Why didn't he go and have a cup of tea with her? Why didn't he stay over and go back to Yeshiva the next day? Just walk. He was outside his house already. For 12 years he hadn't been with his wife. And he overhears that she's prepared to let them go. What would you say, Jackie, if you said that your husband can go to Yeshiva for 12 years, and after 12 years he comes back and he overhears you say he could go for another 12 years, he's becoming such a tzaddik, time to talk him, when he turned around and went without even coming to say hello to you, what would you have to say about him? If that's what Yeshiva is teaching you, then come back, no more 12 years. And why did he go in? Asks Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz, what kind of derecheret is that? And you remember his answer, the 12 and 12 doesn't make 24. Where there's been a hefsek, where you've broken off your line of thinking, even for a brief moment, it's not that you can learn for 1 hour and another hour and that's equal to 2 hours. 2 hours of consistent learning is worth a lot more than 1 hour plus 1 hour. And he used to give the example also with Yaakov, that it says Vayalen Sham Bamokam Ahu, where Yaakov came to sleep at Beit El, and it says he put a stone, they lay on the ground, and he put a stone at his head and he went to sleep. And it says Vayalen Sham, he slept there, and Chazal say there he slept. That was the first time in his 14 years, in his 20 years of learning by Shem Ve'Evri, he was learning in Yeshiva for 20 years, and that was the first time in 20 years that he slept, says Reb Chaim Shmuel Levitz, not even with a stone as his pillow did he sleep. It's not the first time that he slept in a bed. It's not the first time that he slept in on a seated postrapedic. It was the first time he slept even on the ground with a stone as a pillow. What kind of Mishugana is that? 20 years without sleeping? Surely you can take off here and then and an evening and go to sleep. So you'll stay an extra, you'll make up the time. You can't make up. Once there's been a hefsek, it's very difficult to make up. So I think that we usually find that after there's been a break in shiurim, it takes a long time before people are coming again and before we're back into the swing of things. And I'm very pleased to see those of you who are here this evening, and the Yirtzeh Hashem will build up as we have been until the end of the year. The parasha of Bereishis is just each pasuk is we could give 10 Matzah Shabbos Shiurim on each pasuk. Go through it and be busy on it for years and years. What I want to do with you though is to deal with a question that the Rambam asks, and with the Perush of the Sipurna, because the Sipurna has a shita right through the parasha and the particular subject that we'll be dealing with, which is consistently in accordance with the Rambam's principles in the Moreh Nevuchim. I'm sorry you don't have texts in front of you. We are busy trying to get ourselves a photostat machine so that before the shiur we'll be able to print out any text that we'll be using during the shiur, and you'll be able to follow inside. I want to concentrate a lot more in the future on teaching you how to extract the principles from the Rishonim, how to learn the Rashis, how to learn the Sipurunas, not just to hear them, but actually to see it in the words. Because that, after all, is what it's all about. That's the whole skill. The Rambam asks the following question in the second Perek of Moreh Nevuchim, of the Guide to the Perplexed. He says, from the parasha, from Bereishis, it would appear that Adam, the man that was initially created, was a bit of a nebuchal. He didn't know much difference between good and bad, and he had no desire to do bad. He intuitively did what was right and what was expected of him and what was good, and that was it. And says the Rambam, his punishment for disobeying his one mitzvah, the serious punishment for disobeying the one mitzvah which he had to observe, so the Rambam appears to be that he was given the greatest gift of mankind, seichel. He got, for disobeying the Ribbono Shel Olam, he got seichel. So what he was meant to be was a spineless nebuchal, and what he turned out to be after disobeying the Ribbono Shel Olam is a man of great intellectual stature. What's gone wrong? Now I'm going to switch to the Sipurna because I want to show you inside. And those of you who have the time should revise the shiur with a tape and with a chumash in front of you and should go through the Sipurna inside to see the whole thing. And then I'll tell you the Rambam. But then basically the Sipurna tackles the whole parasha absolutely in accordance with the views of the Rambam. Firstly, what does it mean when we're told right at the beginning, Vayivra Elohim Eso Odom Betzalmo, and God created man in his image, Betzelim Elohim Boro Eso, in the image of the Ribbono Shel Olam he created him, Zachor Nekeva Boro Eso. What does this mean, God created man in his image? That's the first thing, if we're going to understand ourselves as people, and that's after all the first thing we need to understand if we're going to learn the Torah, and this is the beginning of the Torah, it's the first Pasha. So here we're going to have the key to the Torah. In order to understand the Torah, you have to understand the words of the Chumash, and you have to understand who the Chumash is addressed to. So there are really three things we need in order to understand the Torah. We need to understand the text, we need to understand something about the author, the Ribbono Shel Olam, and we need to understand something about the people to whom it is directed, that's ourselves. And all that is really covered in the first Parsha. In the first Parsha, we're given the basics, we're given the insight and the key to an understanding of the Torah, to an understanding of the author, and to an understanding of the audience, of ourselves. And this evening what we're going to be primarily concerned with is an understanding of ourselves. And the first thing we need to know is that the pshat of that pasuk. What does it mean? Vayivra Elohim Eso Odom Betzalmoi Betzelim Elohim Boro Eso. God created man in his image, in the image of God he created him. It's a wonderful pasuk. It creates great feelings of optimism and hope in each one of us. It's based on that pasuk that people always say, every man is in the image of God and you must respect every man, and human beings are human beings, and whole philosophies, most of them Christian in formation, are based on that pasuk. And they're based in many cases, and if not in all cases, on an incorrect understanding of that pasuk. What the pshat really is, what it really means, Betzelim Elohim Boro Eso, that's what we need to look at. And we're going to use the Sipurna right through. There are other perushim. Rashi is very scant on this. And to work out what Rashi's shita really is in the whole thing is a little bit more difficult. But the Sipurna goes right through with the shita of the Rambam, and therefore we're in very safe hands. If we understand this parsha the way the Sipurna and the Rambam did, we're in safe hands, and that's what we're going to do this evening in Mitzvah. Now I have to learn with you a Sipurna. A Sipurna which will change your attitudes to what this pasuk means and what life is all about, what human beings are all about. Betzelem Elohim, says the Sipurna. We'll just go through the Sipurna word for word. It's one of the longest Sipurnas. Hinei milas Elohim al tzad hahidomos. When the word Elohim is being used in its comparative sense, not just in its absolute sense. When Elohim is being used in an absolute sense, it means God. But here it must mean something else, because the Sipurna is worried, as is everybody else. What does it mean, we're created in the image of God? As the Rambam says in the first perek of Mori Nevuchim, he says a lot of theologians have made the mistake of learning pshat in this posuk to the effect where they conclude that God must have a form. Not a physical form, not a flesh and blood form, more of a spiritual form, but some form he must have, because we're created in his image. So there must be some similarity between our appearance and his appearance. He must have an appearance. That's what the Rambam asks and points out, the mistaken attitude that many have drawn from this passage. Says the Sipurna, he says, Elohim, when Elohim is used in its absolute sense, that means God. But when it's outside Hahidamut, when it's talking in a relative sense, Te amer al kol etzim sichli befoal sholem nivdal michoimer. That's his definition of Elohim. It's based on the Rambam. Every word of the Sipurna is based on the Rambam. I'll read it again and we'll translate it. Al kol etzim sichli befoal sholem nivdal michoimer. On any intellectual essence in complete actuality as opposed to potential. Okay, you'll understand as we go along. Separated from physical things, from matter. That's what Elohim means. It's an important thing. The Sipurna is telling us what the word Elohim means. The word Elohim means any
essence of intellect fully expressed, separated from any matter. The Rambam explains in his answer to the second question which I raised, that is the comparison between the image of a human being and the image of God. So the Rambam, one needs to know the pshat of a few Hebrew words. The first Hebrew word one needs to know is tzelem. Now you know that a tzelem, a cross is called a tzelem, the Christian image. Idols are called tzelomim. Here we have the word lahavdil, we have the word tzelem. What does tzelem mean? Says the Rambam, tzelem means essence. It doesn't mean image. So already we have a mistake. We're all brought up on the King James version of the Chumash, not on Rashi or the Sipunas version of the Chumash, and we're all brought up with completely wrong understandings and wrong translations. Right? The word tzelem does not mean image, and it does not mean form. It cannot mean that. How can you talk about the image of God? How can you talk about the form of God? It can't be. It's partial. It's just impossible. It says the first thing the Rambam says, tzelem means essence. Form, he says, is toar. The word Torah means form. We had it in Shmuel with the ladies today. Yefei Torah, good to look at, of good form. When a person is handsome and of good form, we say Yefei Torah, not Yefei Tzelem. So when we're talking about a physical image, we talk about Torah. When we're talking about an essence, not an image, an essence, then we talk about Tzelem. And he says that's why idols are called Salomim. Because people who worship idols are not worshipping the form of the idols. They're not idiots. They know that a chunk of wood can't bring rain and can't give fortunes. They know that. Do you think the ancient Greeks and all their brilliance and all the intellectual genius didn't realize that idols were worthless things? But they were worshipping the tzelem, the essence of what that idol represented. That's what they were worshipping. So when we talk about a tzelem, we're talking about the essence of the thing, not the form of the thing. We're not interested in the form. That's the first thing that we need to remember. These are all yesodas. You must remember these, because these are yesodas. These are not just little anecdotes. These are fundamental principles that one needs in one's understanding of Chumash and Tanakh. One can't move without these things. That's tzelem. The second one is Torah, which is the external form, and the third one is demus. Demus comes from the word domeh, which means to be similar to. And demus, says the Rambam, is when you are like something, but not in its essence, but you like certain aspects of it. There are certain similarities. That's what demus means. And now we see those two words, tzelem and demus, play an important part in the view of the Sipurna. Now you'll understand these words in the Sipurna a little bit better. So the word Elohim is now al kol etzem sikhli, any essential body of intellect, before shalem, in complete expression, nivdal b'chome, separated from matter. And that makes it eternal. Let's go on a little bit, otherwise you won't understand it. And that's why God is called Elohim. It's not the other way around. That's why God is called Elohim, because he fits that definition. He is completely intellectual. He's a concept in a sense. He's completely thought. Again, it will become clearer just now. Separated from matter. And it is an essence. And completely expressed. That's why he's called Elohim. Va'al Malacho. And that's why angels are called Elohim. Sometimes angels are called Elohim too. And who else is called Elohim? Ribon Yishalem, angels, and who else? Sorry? Judges. Talmidei Chachomim also called Elohim. Uchamoy kein teomer ala shoftim. And that's why shoftim are also called Elohim. Al shem hachelek hasichli haro'i bohem. Because of the intellectual side of them, that's why they're called Elohim. Omnam b'yos ki asechel ha'enoshi afal pi shepu'ulas haskaloso hu bilti shum kli chomri. He says, and if you note, you will see that the human intellect doesn't operate through a physical tree, a physical organ. The brain is not really the organ of the intellect. The intellect actually operates on it. It's based in the brain, and it's, but the brain is not where it's all about. You can analyze the brain until you burn the face. From a medical and scientific analysis of the brain, you will not come to understand the nature of creative genius. It's not that they're not that connected. It doesn't have a place. It's not like an arm and a leg and a nose and a mouth and an ear. It's not. Intellect doesn't have that kind of organ. V'hispashet al bilti muchash, and it spreads into areas that are abstract. The intellect is the only part of the human being that can handle abstract things. It doesn't have to be via the senses. You don't have to be able to. The intellect can work with things that cannot be seen, that cannot be heard, that cannot be felt, that cannot be smelt, and that cannot be tasted. You can even work with your intellect on future things, on things that haven't even occurred yet. You can project. Listen to this very carefully, ladies and gentlemen. It doesn't get weakened with excessive use. And it doesn't get weaker as you get older. It gets stronger as you get older, if you've been using it. And from all these descriptions of it, it becomes clear that the intellect is separate from matter. It's not matter. It's something godly. It doesn't operate by the normal laws of nature. The normal laws of nature would determine that the more you use it, the weaker it gets. The older you get, the weaker it gets. That it should only be able to handle physical things, not conceptual things. Bli sofek, without a doubt. Ki omnam hefech kol ele yikre lekoiches haguf hachoimrius. Because any physical powers that a human being has, the opposite occurs. As you get older, it gets weaker. As you use it more, it gets more tired. That's the first half of the Sipurna. That the intellect, the seichel ha'enoshi, is something spiritual, it's not something physical. And that's where psychiatry is going all wrong. They haven't learned the Sipurna yet. It's not medical doctors that are going to find the answers to psychiatric problems. I'm not talking about clinical problems where a person has a hormonal imbalance or something wrong with his brain cells. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about psychiatric problems where his body's okay, which is most psychiatric problems. Psychiatry is not an element of medicine. It has nothing to do with medicine. And as soon as they'll start understanding that psychiatry has very little to do with medicine, and it's a completely different branch, and that psychiatrists need to be trained in Torah, that psychiatrists need to be trained in spiritual things and spiritual areas. The one psychiatrist who understood that was Viktor Frankl. That really, and he writes, in fact, that the modern psychiatrist takes the place of the old rabbi. And that's part of the problem. The psychiatrist today is meant to be doing, although he's ill-equipped to do what the Rabbonim used to do in days gone by, with more success. That's the first section of the Sipurna, the second section. Mikolmokum, nevertheless, he says, Kaidim shi yisboinen. Before you've applied your intellect, as meshulal mikol shlemus, asher huchanle, then you are lacking this kind of perfection. You have the potential, but you haven't used it, you haven't developed it, then you're lacking it. Loi yikore elokim, then you're not called elokim. Aval yikore tselem elokim bilvad, then you're called tselem elokim. Ad shi yikne shleimus bifrat bechochma, until you've actually acquired perfection in wisdom, in intellect, asher bo yikne avas hakel v'yirosoi, through which you can develop Avas Hashem, love of God and fear of God. It's all through the intellect. One has to know, you're working with God. How can you develop a love and an awareness of the Ribbono Shel Olam without using your cup a little bit? And until you've developed your wisdom and your intellect to the point where you can apply yourself, that's called Tzelem Elokim. Ka'az yeh etzim sikli before Hasholim, then you'll be in action. Nivdal Mechomer, and then you'll be separated from the physical. And that's why you will last after your death. That's what determines that you last after your death. This is important Sipurna. The fact that you've applied your intellect, that intellect doesn't get old when you get old, it doesn't get tired when your body gets tired, and it doesn't die when you die. It's not governed by the laws of your body at all. It operates independent of your body. And that's why you can have sick, broken old people who are intellectual wizards and geniuses. It doesn't matter. It's not necessary that a healthy body creates a healthy mind. It's not necessary. Sometimes it assists, and sometimes a broken body can be a disturbance in other ways. But in essence, it's not necessary, so the mind operates separately from the body. And therefore, the body can die and be left behind to rot and to do whatever it does afterwards. But the seichel doesn't die as a result of that. It isn't, during the life, it didn't follow the laws of the body, and after death, it doesn't follow the laws of the body. And since it lies in the choice of man to acquire this perfection, by his efforts to to dwell and to conceive of this wisdom, hine his boyerit emerges, shekasher yimno atzmei mizeret, when he doesn't do that, yishoyer koichoi hatzichli al chayusoi, then his intellectual powers remain attached to his body, mishulal mikol shleimus, lacking in any perfection, befoal in actuality, only in potential.
This word is a little bit not clear.
V'yale betoyu v'ye alved, and then when he dies, he's dead. Everything goes. There's nothing. He hasn't left anything behind. Thoughts are the only thing that can live. The one's intellect, one's mind, and the development of one's mind, that carries on. But if you haven't developed your mind, so all you've got is a brain. And when the brain rots, you've got nothing. You haven't developed to the point where your thoughts have gone beyond your body, where your thoughts are living in a cycle of their own and are living in a way of their own. Then when you die, everything gets left behind and there's nothing left. Very frightening sipuna. So what do we have is, the sipuna told us that a person who has reached intellectual heights, obviously he's connecting intellectual with spiritual. Although in a sense, intellectually, even without spiritually, what he's saying here is basically that intellectual is spiritual. That a thought, and deep thought, is already spiritual. No matter what you're thinking about, it's already spiritual. It's beyond your body, and that stays behind. If your thoughts are negative, you'll have to account for them one day. And if your thoughts are positive, you'll be credited with them one day. They carry on, they live. And if your thoughts are non-existent, nothing. When you die, you're dead. That's the end of the day. And Tselem Elohim means a potential Elohim. That's what it means. So now when people go around and they say you must respect every human being because every human being is created in the image of God, wrong. That's a Christian idea. It's not a Jewish idea. On the basis of the Sipuna. I say again, on the basis of the Sipuna, whether there are any that are chilek with the Rambam on this, I don't know. I haven't found any yet. But for the moment, let's go along assuming that this is the way. And on the basis of this, that attitude is wrong and it's not Jewish, it's not authentic. I must respect everybody because they're created in the image of God. Nonsense! Who's created in the image of God? Tell him Elohim, that means everybody is created a potential Talmid Chacham. That's what it means. That's what the Tell him Elohim means. Everybody is created as a potential intellectual giant. That's all. So in that much, yes, I must respect everybody. Everybody is a potential intellectual giant, but you remember what the Talmud Dvorah said on Yom Tif? You know, if a man is a potential intellectual giant and he doesn't achieve that potential, is that a reason to respect him? It's not a reason to respect him, on the contrary. That's a reason to feel let down by him. This potential creates tremendous responsibility in a human being. And one doesn't necessarily have to respect the man who's not living up to that potential, and who isn't developing that potential, and who isn't making efforts to bring that potential into fruition. Just by the fact that he's got two hands and two legs and a head on his shoulders and he walks around, is that the image of God? And when he walks around with his shirt open until his belly button, and that, is that the image of God? That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam looks like. And it's Meshuggah. Not at all. The image of God is in the Tzelem Elohim. The image of God is in his ability to achieve the level of Elohim, which the Sipuna defines as the level of intellectual separation, where you can start operating in a plane disassociated from your physical body. That's it. You can live, you can despite, and that's why you have Gedolim who with suffering, tremendous suffering, were able to achieve heights in their learning. The two don't go together, the two aren't connected. That's what Betzelem Elohim means. What does Bidmut Elohim mean? There are two sipunas on that. I'm only going to deal with the one with you. I'll tell you where the other one is in case you want to look at it yourselves. There's one on Bereshis Aleph Kaf Vav, where the sipuna again discusses the two words, Tzelem and Dmus. The one where he puts it very succinctly is in Bereishis, chapter Dalit, chapter Hay, the very beginning of chapter Hay, the first pasuk of chapter Hay. That sefer toldos Adam, this is the book of the generations of man, beyom bero Elohim Adam, on the day that Hashem created man, bidmus Elohim osa osa. Now it's not Tzelem, it's Dmus all of a sudden. God created man, bidmus, again in the image of God. What does bidmus Elohim mean? Says the Sipunu, Bidmus Elohim also isoy Baal Bechira, that he has free choice. That's the Dmus. Now in the earlier Sipunu, which I mentioned to you but didn't read to you, the Sipunu basically defines that Tselem is in man's makeup, in his potential. Demus is in his behavior. Right? So God created us betzalmoi and bidmusoi. Betzalmoi, he gave us the potential to become intellectual giants, every one of us. And bidmusoi, he gave us bechira. He gave us the ability to choose. Says the Sifur Nebal Bechira, Lepichach lefo, kishehich isu had doiroisov, lifnei hakel yizborach, when the generations later on anger Hashem, nein shu, they get punished. And that's where, how this posuk starts off. Zeh sefer tolus Adam, this is the story of the generation of mankind. Says the Sifur Nebal, the first thing it's telling us is that man was created bidmus elikim. Why is it important to know that? Because to know that we are responsible beings. We're responsible because we have free choice. So what are the two godly things about us? Our potential and our responsibility. So what do you do with a man who doesn't develop that potential? What do you do with a man who doesn't accept that responsibility or makes a mess of that responsibility? Respect him because he's created in the image of God. Why? He deserves no respect whatever. Except as much as you would respect any creature. Less than you would respect any creature. An animal doesn't make such a mess of his responsibilities. One gives him, actually one accords him less respect than you would accord an animal. It's a mistaken idea, and it's not a Jewish idea, that everybody must be respected, everybody must be loved, everybody is wonderful because we're all created in the image of God. Not correct. Nobody is created in the image of God except in as much as two factors. We have the potential to become great, and we have the responsibility for our actions. We have bechira. We have the ability to choose. That is our godliness, and if we make a mess of that, we no longer have the image of God. That's not the image of God. Now, that's the introduction. With that, we can understand a lot more clearly what went wrong with Adam, and answer the Rambam's first question that I started off with. That was, what was Adam before the chet, and what was Adam after the chet? Now, when was Adam created? Before that, I must read you one other sifuna, which is not directly connected, but is just so very interesting. I always say, you know, we have to be very careful not to be dogmatic in the Torah. I don't know whether evolution's right or evolution's wrong. I'm not a scientist. All I know is there are certain aspects of evolution which could fit into the Torah, and there are certain aspects of evolution which cannot fit into the Torah. There are certain things that it's easier for me to believe that they took place the way the Torah puts them than the way the evolutionists put them, which sometimes I find a bit difficult to believe. But it doesn't make much difference. But what the Sipuna does say, on Vayipach bi'apov nishmas chayim, and he breathed into him a breath of life, Vayihi Odom lenefesh chayo, and Odom was a living being, says the Sipuna, Vayipach bi'apov nishmas chayim nefesh chiyunis, a living life. That just means he made him from something non-living to something living. Muchenes lekabil tzelem elokim, ready to accept that potential greatness. Right? So at that point he didn't even have the potential, he didn't even have the tzelem. The tzelem elokim he didn't have yet. Mikol makom, nevertheless, vayehi adam lenefesh chayo, man was a living being. Hayo al kol zeh, even though he didn't yet have the tzelem elokim, chayo bilvad, he was only an animal. Listen to this. Adam was only an animal. Bilti medaberes, unable to speak. Ad she nivro betzelem udmus, until he was finally given that tzelem udmus. It's mefurish in the Sipurna that there was a period of time during which man was an animal, incapable of speech, incapable of intellect. And that animal was given the Tzelem Elokim. He was prepared for it. The animal was made ready to accept that Tzelem Elokim. And that's the Ribbono Shelam gave him. So when I say that there are certain parts of evolution that are acceptable and certain parts that aren't, and certain that might be or might not be, that Adam was created, that the body of man could have been created from the body of an animal, definitely could be. The Sipurna virtually says so openly, long before Darwin was even thought of. The Ramban says something very similar on the same posuk. But that the next step was just part of the evolutionary process, that's quite unacceptable. The jump from whatever this being was, to Adam, to the man who was created in the image of God, the Tzelem Elokim, that was no evolutionary process. That was the Ribbono Shel Olam taking this clod of animal, whatever he was, and converting him revolutionarily, not evolutionarily, into a new being, into a human being, somebody capable of greatness. So how the body evolved, that we don't know. But one thing is for sure, that stage of becoming a human being, chas v'sholem, there was no evolution involved in that whatever. But the body could have been.
Now, once we've got that, before the sin,
how much did Adam have? What was Adam like before the sin? So he had tzelem elokim. He had the capacity for intellectual genius. That was before the sin. He had bechira. He was created bidmus elokim. He was created in the other word that's used for the image of God, bidmus elokim. So before he ate from the tree, he had intellectual greatness, and he had demus, and he had bechira. He had freedom of will. So what did he achieve from eating the tree? What changed? One thing, says the Rambam already, you see, he was no Nebuchadnezzar before he started. This was a man of unbelievable stature before even eating from the tree. Now, what did eating from the tree give him? Here again, the Sipuna follows faithfully the Shita of the Rambam.
Eitz Hadas, this is the Sipuna now, defining what was the Eitz Hadas. It's in chapter Beis. On Posuk Tes.
Posuk 9, on chapter 2.
Eitz Hadas, may see loseth lev el hatoy vahora.
Firstly, the Sipunus takes das, the word knowledge, and he translates that in a very different way. He takes knowledge and he says knowledge means noticing, observance, observation. The reason he does that is obvious. He couldn't have acquired more knowledge than he had. He's been made. Betzelem Elokim, what did we say Betzelem Elokim was? With the capacity for full intellectual genius before he ate. So what can the Eitz Hadas give him in knowledge? There's no knowledge that he's lacking. All he's got to do is he's got to build himself and he's got to utilize that knowledge, but there's nothing that's lacking. What could the Eitz Hadas give him? What could the tree of knowledge give him? It can't be knowledge. Says the Sipuna, Eitz Hadas means the tree of observation. It made him begin to notice. Which is an interesting concept altogether, the relationship between das, between knowledge, and between observation, between noticing.
When it says, for example, that man knew his wife.
This is in our parashah. Adam yodo is ishto. What does that mean? Nosan leivol leho. It means that he gave, that he noticed her, that he took note of her.
Umizeh nikra hakorod moido.
And that's why a relation is called a moida, somebody known, somebody you take notice of. Because one usually pays attention to the needs of one's relatives, or in those days one did anyway.
Toivara,
what does good and bad mean? So now we know what Eitz Hadas means. We've got to now know what Eitz Hadas Toivara means. The tree of knowledge of good and bad. What does it mean? The tree of knowledge means the tree which opened his eyes to the observation of Tov V'ra. What is Tov V'ra? Says the Sipurna, a strange thing. Livchoir ha'orev afal pishi yazik. To choose things which are pleasant even though they might be harmful. V'limuiz habilti orev afal pishi yoyil. And to despise the unpleasant even though they might be helpful. That was the Tov V'ra. Where does he get that from? It's again the Rambam. The Rambam in the second chapter of Moreh Nevuchim draws a very important distinction between true and false on the one hand, emes for sheker on the one hand, and on the other hand, between ugly and beautiful. Two different things. And he says, emes for sheker is something you can work out with your brain. Whether something is true or false, that's something you can work out. It's intellectually conceivable. And it's absolute. Whether something is ugly or beautiful, that he says is a social norm. That depends on the society in which you live. There are some societies where people consider one thing beautiful and another society will consider the same thing ugly. That just depends on upbringing, it depends on conditioning, it depends on civilizations, it depends on a whole lot of things, but it's not an absolute which you can work out. The Greeks tried to work out absolute principles of aesthetic beauty, and they made a bit of a mess of it. Because if you look at what is their absolute beauty, they are mathematically beautiful in the sense of they are perfectly harmonious. But they don't create a warm, genuine beauty. It's not the kind of beauty that stirs one. It's the beauty that if you then study it, yeah, you can see the mathematical relationships between spaces. But it's not the kind of beauty that you look at and you say, wow, that's really moving, that's fantastic. It's a classical kind of beauty which is different altogether. Beauty and ugliness, pleasantness and unpleasantness, good taste and bad taste, that's a social thing. That people decide among themselves. That's not an absolute thing and it's not something you can work out. So So says the Rambam, when Adam was created, he was created with the capacity for intellectual genius. So what can you do with intellectual genius? You can work out what's true and what's false. That's what you can do. Can you work out with intellectual genius what's nice and what's not nice? Says you can't. You can be the biggest genius in the world and you won't work that out. Go and figure out why he likes that thing and he likes something else. And figure out how many times you hear people say, now why did he marry her? What did he see in her? And you can have all the geniuses in the world sitting around the tea tables discussing what he saw in her and unable to reach a conclusion. They don't know. They don't understand. Well, when you come to taste, when you come to beauty, when you come to pleasantness and unpleasantness, go and understand. Two people will go into a shop, and the husband and wife, and the husband will say, I think we should buy that furniture there. And the wife will say, my goodness, I couldn't live with it in my room. I'd go out of my mind if we had that in the house. How can that be? Is it nice or isn't it nice? Is it beautiful or is it ugly? Why can't the one convince the other? You can't with taste. It's personal. It's social. It's upbringing. It's not something that you can rationalize and say, well, that is beautiful, therefore we should have it, or that isn't beautiful. It's taste. Therefore, says the Rambam, even a genius such as Adam HaRishon was unable with his intellect to work out what's nice and what's not nice. All he could work out is what is true and what is false. Tovara, good and bad, that's what the Rambam is a word that means. It can sometimes be referring to true and false as well, but normally Tovara is good and bad in a relative sense, not in an absolute sense. And that you only start understanding when you experience it. Go and imagine that our children would never have tasted anything sweet. They wouldn't have tasted sweets, and they wouldn't have tasted chocolates, and they wouldn't have tasted anything like that. Let's say we would condition them that vitamin tablets are nice, they're lovely, we all yum yum, we all love vitamin tablets, and we all love fruits, and this kind of thing. Let's say they were all conditioned that way, and there was no chance of any child landing up in somebody else's house where he's offered a fruit, where he's offered a sweet. That would be no problem. So he wouldn't want sweets. He wouldn't like sweets. He would find no pleasure in them at all, until you've experienced it. When you've experienced it, and it's nice, it creates a nice sensation, and other people also regard it as nice. Then you start understanding the toif. You start understanding that it's good. Don't explain to somebody who's not a smoker the pleasures of smoking. Can't explain. You take this paper and you wrap it around some leaves, some dried out leaves, and you light it and you breathe in the smoke. Ah, and it's wonderful. And look at you as if you're a sugar. So try and work it out scientifically. Will you see there's a certain drug in the tobacco? And it doesn't make any difference. He thinks as you're talking, he envisages himself locked up in a room filled with burning wood and paper and breathing the stuff in, and he can't imagine what kind of pleasure you find in it. Until he has found pleasure in it, now he understands. When it comes to taste, when it comes to good and bad in sense of pleasant and unpleasant, that's experience. Until you have the experience, you don't know what it's about. There's no way that you can know what it's about. But true and false, that you can rationalize, that you can figure out even though you've never experienced. That one man can prove to another. I can sit and I can prove to you that what you're saying is not true, it's not right, it's incorrect. But I can't prove to you that the tie that you're wearing is ugly. That I can't do. Not possible. You either understand it or you don't understand it. And if you think it's beautiful, good. So you think it's beautiful. But there's no argument about that. And if people would understand that, also it would save a lot of arguments. That there's certain things about which you cannot argue, such as taste. The eating from the tree, that was the first time that Adam experienced the conflict between what is tasty and what is right. Here he was able to eat a delicious fruit that looked fantastic and tasted wonderful, and it was naughty. It was wrong. It was the first time that he experienced the conflict, the mixing up of good and bad with right and wrong. That was the first time. And once he'd experienced it, that changes everything. Now that you know the pleasure that something can give you, even though it's wrong, before that he didn't know. Whatever he did, whatever he got pleasure from was right. Whatever was wrong, he didn't do. The concept that you can find something physically pleasurable, although it's wrong, that was something which Adam had never experienced. Never having experienced it, he didn't understand it, he didn't know it, no matter how genius he was. With all the intellect, it was something he couldn't understand, and didn't have to understand. And so all his dedication was just to right, just to truth, to something which is delicious but dangerous. He had no interest. Until, we won't go into the whole story of how it happened with the snake and the chav and the whole business, but the fact is it landed up retrospectively that he looked at himself and said, my goodness, that was delicious. What was it? That was the stuff you weren't supposed to eat. Wasn't it delicious? Wasn't it nice? That's what the Nachash wanted. The Nachash wanted Adam to experience the conflict between that which is nice and that which is right. And that's the conflict which has got humanity into the mess that it is today, subsequently. Because if that would never have happened, imagine that Adam would never have tasted it. And nobody ever would have tasted anything delicious that is treif. Imagine if all our experiences were kosher. We would never have experienced anything wrong, nor experienced anything ugly. All our experiences would have been good, sweet, and right. It would be a pleasure. Life would be very simple and very clear cut. Our only decisions would have to be, is this straight or is it crooked? Is this right or is it wrong? Is it true or is it false? And that we could sit down and we could work out. What is introduced over here is passion. Once you've tasted something delicious, once you've tasted something sweet, which might be wrong, and that becomes something on its own, that becomes, it becomes a force on its own now. It's something that motivates people. You're motivated now not just by right and wrong and true and false, but you're motivated also by passions. Now it's a different story. It's not just the passion for a sweet, and it's not just the passion for a piece of meat which isn't kosher, and it's not just the passion for going on holiday on the Shabbos or going out to the Val on the Shabbos. It's now a passion for wealth. It's a passion for honor. It's a passion for prestige. It's a passion for all sorts of things that start wrecking one. And one starts finding that one can find pleasure in experiences which aren't quite kosher. That one can start just using ends to justify means, and one can do all sorts of things which aren't right. But they bring one nachas. And that changes the whole ballgame. And in fact, it starts making it very difficult to start sorting out now what is right and what is wrong. Because you can't work it out as rationally and as coldly as you were able to do before. So let's now just look at Adam before the Chet and Adam after the Chet, and you'll see the thing emerging very clearly, and also a very much clearer understanding of our souls and our passions and our conflicts. Adam before the Chet was a complex man, but not a complicated man. He was complex in the sense that Tzelem Elokim, Bidmus Elokim, incredible genius with total responsibility for himself, the ability to choose to do whatever he wanted. And the ability to figure out what's right and what is wrong. Intellectually, he could take any moral issue, any situation, and with his brain he could work out, is this right or is it wrong? That's why in those days the Torah didn't need to be given from Mount Sinai. Each man would have been able to work it out himself, just sit down and figure out, tefillin, I've got to do this, I mustn't do each thing, he would have worked out, it's all logical. After the chet, a new thing comes in. Now the other desires become involved. The desire for gratification through means which are not allowed. That's what there are now, other forms of gratification other than that which is true, other than that which is straight. And that starts distorting one's understanding and one's ability to analyze what is true and what is false and what is right and what is wrong. One more sipurna we need to do. We will understand the role of death. How does the Ribbono Shel deal with this? What does he do? Now we have a problem. His whole intention, in a sense, of the creation of man has changed now. Adam is not what God created him. He's a different being now.
So it says God, Vayomer Hashem Elokim, and God says, this is in chapter Gimel, verse Kaf Beis, Hein ha'odom hoyo ka'achad mimenu. Adam has now become like one of us, lodas tovera. He knows good and bad. Terribly difficult passage to understand. The ato and now pen yishlach yodoi, let him just send out his hand, velokach gam eitzah chayim, and he might take also from the tree of life, v'ochal and he'll eat v'chay lo ilom, and then he'll live forever.
What's God worried about? Say he'll live forever. Isn't God a loving, merciful God? He should have such nachas, Adam will live forever.
Says the tikkun once again.
Ke'echod mimenu ladas tovera, hu yodea tovera. Now man knows Tovara. How did the Sipuna define knows Tovara? He has begun to take an interest in pleasant and unpleasant. Right? Remember that definition. Das, according to the Sipuna, is noticing. He has become observant. His eyes have opened to a new area of experience. No longer just the intellectual. No longer just the experience of what is right and what is wrong, what is straight and what is crooked. But he has a new area of experience now. Tovara. He's taken an interest in what is pleasant and what is unpleasant. Im hi yose b'talmenu. Despite the fact that he's b'talmenu, that he is this genius capable of becoming Elohim, capable of becoming so great. And if in addition to this, in this way, he's also going to be eternal. Hinei, listen to this, behold, Yirdoiv kol hayomim achar ha'orev, v'yashlich acharei givoy, kol hasogus sichlis v'chol ma'ase toiv, v'lo yosig ha'oishir haruchoni, ha'mechuvel meis ha'kel yizborach b'tzalmud musay. Let's translate. If now, having become awakened to pleasant and unpleasant, despite the fact that he has made the Tzelem Elikim, if he will also be eternal, he will pursue all his life pleasant things, and he will throw over his back all intellectual achievements and all good actions, and he will not achieve the spiritual wealth which was intended by God in creating somebody. The intention of his creation will be denied because of his pursuit of pleasure. Who are we talking about here? We're not talking about some 1960s hedonist. We're talking about Odom Arisha, the greatest of all men. Yetzir Kapov, a man that was designed and made by the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. As great as he is with the Tzelem Elikim and with the Demus Elikim, says the Sikh. Now we see the role of death. It's only death, it's the termination of his eternity, which is going to enable him to get back to where he needs to be. Now a new element needs to be thrown in. As long as man was an intellectual being, he was able coldly and rationally to decide this is good and this is bad, this is true and this is false, and I must do that which is good, he didn't need death. What do you need death for? He'll do which is good, and the longer he lives, the more good he'll do. Once he's tasted pleasantness, once he's had geschmack from a glass of wine or whatever that fruit was that he ate from, and he's experienced what it's nice to live nicely, and other aspects start becoming involved, that will distort him. What does it mean that Odom Arisha is going to run around and spend his nights in the bars and go and lie on the beach and go to Sun City? Is that what it means, Chas v'Shalom? But it means that even his pursuit of spiritual things is going to be tainted and coloured, and it's not going to be truly spiritual, and it's not going to be truly intellectual, and it's not going to be truly good. And everything he does, there's going to be a touch of the desire for pleasantness, a touch of the easy, a touch of the nice, a touch of the pleasant, and everything he does. Well, come, he'll be learning very nicely, but he's got to go to a shir, it's raining outside, it's a bit of a step, it's more comfortable to stay inside. What is that that says, I don't want to get wet, I don't want to go outside, it's miserable outside? Is that a craving for knowledge? Is that a desire to learn about truth? That's the tree, you've tasted what it's like to be comfortable. And it affects the other things too. And you know how one starts reasoning? No, really, I would go. Of course I would go to a shir. What do you think? Because it's raining, I wouldn't go to a shir. Chas v'Shalom, but I know what he's going to be doing today. He's going to be going over the same stuff that he did last week. In any case, I know that. In any case, I'll sit here and I'll learn myself rather. I'll do some new stuff. It'll be better for me. So one justifies it. Isn't one a tzaddik? But that's not why you're not there. You're not there because it's uncomfortable to be there. That's why you're not there. And the rest is all rationalization. And so it goes on with everything one does. It's the twisting and the distorting and the rationalizing that goes on in order to keep oneself comfortable, in order to take the easy way out. That was the tragedy of eating. There's only one thing we have which can save us from that. And that's miso. That's what we have to call, now understanding this. After the gift of Seicha, and after the gift of Bechira, and as a consequence of the Aveira, of the sin of Odom Arishon, that which we can only call the most wonderful gift of death, that termination of eternity. The only thing that can shake us out of that lethargy, the only thing that can make us make a choice for that which is right, irrespective of its comfort or discomfort, the only thing that can make us be Moser Nefesh, to give our lives for that which is right, to experience discomfort for that which is right, to sit up a few extra hours working on something that needs to be resolved, to go out of our way to do a chesed which costs us a little bit, to go to a shir when it's raining and when it's miserable, the only thing that can really do that is the knowledge that we don't live forever. And every moment that goes past is gone and foregone, and it doesn't come back. If we knew that tomorrow is also a day, we would always postpone everything worthwhile until tomorrow, and we would do everything pleasant today. That's how we would be. We'd do all the nice things today, all the comfortable things today. I'll make it up tomorrow. I'll get a tape of the shir. I'll learn with a chavrusa. Tomorrow's also a day. Death is that gift which tells us tomorrow is not a day. You don't know that tomorrow is a day. You might not be here tomorrow. So don't count on tomorrow. All you've got is today. That's all you've got for sure is now. The next minute you don't even have for sure. So utilize that minute to its maximum. That's the only way we've got to overcome the damage caused by the taste of that fruit, of that forbidden fruit which Adam HaRishon had. We now also see, by the way, that fruit wasn't poisonous. It wasn't treif. There was nothing in it that was wrong. And the proof is that according to all the views, today we eat it, whatever it was. Some say it was grapes, some say it was wheat, some say it was figs, whatever it was. Today we eat it. So there's nothing, was nothing inherently treif about it. It was just the concept of something which is delicious and not allowed. And until man had tasted something delicious and not allowed, he was pure. The moment he tasted something that was delicious and wasn't allowed, other elements started coming in. And the only counter effect to that event is the knowledge of death. And now you'll understand the Gemara, which I've quoted many times before, but you'll see this Gemara now just, it's amazing. The principle of Musar. How do you work? What do you do? Gemara in Brachos Daf Hei Amud Aleph. Omer Rabbi Levi Bar Chama Omer Rabbi Shimon Ben Lokish. You must always make war your Yetzer HaTov against your Yetzer Hara. The correct translation of those two words is your passion, your creative desire for good against your Yetzer Hara, against your creative desire for dissipation, your desire for other forms of gratification. Right? Basically, a human being wants to be gratified. You can be gratified by a Yetzer HaTov, which is through creative forms. Yetzer comes from the word Liyatzer, to form, to create. Or Yetzer Hara, you can, if you're not being creative, you can gratify yourselves through all sorts of other ways, by eating from the Etz Hadas. That's the, by doing things which are delicious, although they have no long-term benefit. And the first step to do when you're busy battling, trying to choose between that which is pleasant and that which is good, is Yargiz Odom Yetzer Tov al Yetzer Hara. Try and use your desire for creative satisfaction. Try and use the positive in you to overcome the negative. Don't sit there and say, I mustn't, because I guarantee you and the Gemara guarantees you that you won't win. You might win today and tomorrow you'll do it. The way of doing it is not, oh, I mustn't. Not like, Yargiz Yetzirah Tov, work with your positive aspects. Work with your Yetzirah Tov, try and gratify yourself positively and avoid the need for negative gratification. That's the first thing to try. Im Nitzchoy Mutav, if it works, but well and good. Vim Lav. The Gemara is already indicating that even that might well not work. Yasuk b'Torah. If that doesn't work, then you must learn Torah. What's the idea of learning Torah? We're getting back to the Tzelem Elokim. Try and get back to what Adam was originally meant to be. What did the Sipurna define it as? As developing that intellectual potential to the point where it separates you from your physical being, then you have no Yetzer Hara anymore. At the moment, and that's why at the moment that one's involved in one's learning, one doesn't have Yetzer Hara. It's the most wonderful thing when you're really involved trying to work out a difficult Rambam, no Yetzer Hara. You've got no desire to tell a lie, no matter what for. You've got no desire to eat something you shouldn't eat, to do something you shouldn't do, to say something you shouldn't say, nothing. All your Yetzer Hara goes. Your only Yetzer Hara is in the learning, but you've got to be honest in your learning. But that's another thing. But your basic passions and desires, gone. Why? Because your body's not operating. At that moment you've projected yourself, you've launched yourself out of your body and you're working in something much greater. You're working in something eternal. You're working with Elohim. You're working with that aspect of you which is godly. That's what you're working with. So if that doesn't work, the Yetzirah, working with your positive passions, Yasuk b'Torah, get involved deeply in the learning of Torah. And it's Yasuk, it's not just reading Torah or swatting up Torah. It's Lasuk, it's really delving into Torah with depth. If that works, well and good. Ve'im lav, we've already seen that also might not work. Maybe you won't really get involved in your learning as you should, and you're too disturbed and distracted, and you can't. Im lav. Yikro kriyashma. We should say kriyashma. What's the point? What's the magic there? Well, it's kriyashma you're going to say. What's kriyashma about? Bechira. Your choice. Second paragraph of kriyashma. You can do as you please. You can go left or you can go right, but you'll bear the consequences. If you go the one way, the Rebbeinu Shlomo will reward you. You go the other way, you get punished. That's the Sipurna on Dmus Elohim. If you haven't been able to get to the Tzelem Elohim, you haven't been able to awaken your Tzelem Elohim, try at least to awaken your Dmus Elohim. That after all, you're a Baal Bechira, you have free choice, which makes you responsible for your choices. And what that does, it introduces to you the concept that ultimately, what is wrong is unpleasant too. And what is good will be pleasant. One day it will all work out that way, because you're going to have to bear the responsibility for what you're deciding. In nitzchoy mutav, if that works, well and good. V'im lav, even that might not work. And there's our last resort. Now on this last resort, it doesn't say im lav. It doesn't say if that doesn't work. This one will work. This one's guaranteed. Yizkor l'yom hamisa. Just remember death. Remember that life doesn't go on forever. Remember you don't know what tomorrow is. Remember you don't know what the next minute is. Just remember that there's going to come a time when you're going to die. And at that you'll stop yourself doing anything. There's nothing you won't be able to stop yourself doing if you really are able to live the concept of death. You know, in a man's last moments, what is meaningful to him? Does he sit and think about all the lovely chilul Shabbos he had? Does he sit and think about all the trade things he ate? All the lovely weekends he spent at Sun City? Those things are meaningless. No matter who he is, he can be a real grobnik. At his last moments of life, those aren't the things that make him feel, oh, it's been a worthwhile life. Things of his children and his grandchildren and the few kindnesses he did and the bit of charity he gave, those are the things which are important at that moment. The awareness of death takes away any craving for that which is pleasant. Pleasantness is not important. At the last moments of life, you're not worried about what's pleasant and unpleasant. During those last moments of life, you're worried about what is meaningful and what is not meaningful, what is good and what is not good, what is straight and what is not straight. That's all you're worried about. And if one can somehow bring those moments forward a little bit, without bringing death forward, chas v'shalom, but just to bring those moments of awareness forward a little bit, one will find it a lot easier to sort these things out. And as an aside, one should be aware of the tragedy that occurs when a person when euthanasia is considered. Those can be the moments more than anything else that can bring a person to great spiritual heights. Those last moments, and the closer he comes to death, the closer the moments to death, the more valuable they are. The value of life just increases geometrically during those last days, months, days, hours, minutes. Each breath that he breathes in, each last minute, is something of value, is something where he's busy weighing up and doing cheshbonos and figuring out it's the only time in his life when he sees things in true perspective. He might be suffering, he might be in pain, it doesn't matter, but he's seeing things in true perspective for the first time in his life. You can have some idiotic doctor who wants to walk up there and terminate his life because he's suffering. He's not suffering. He's suffering physically, but he's operating with his mind. Maybe for the first time he's achieving that Tzelem Elokim. Maybe for the first time he's developing the potential into something real and into something actual. Maybe for the first time he's projecting himself beyond his body. And despite that pain and suffering, he's involved in things which are very much greater and very much more worthwhile. How can one terminate that time? In fact, one doctor told me in Israel that his care depends who he's treating. He says, if he's treating Rishoyim, I don't know exactly how he decides. He says, then he drags them at the end and he tries to make it as easy and as quick and as painless for them. He says, but if he's dealing with Tzadikim, he doesn't even like to give them painkillers. Because he knows that those last moments, they want to be alert, and they want to be awake, no matter what the suffering is. He knows that the worst thing you can do to a tzaddik is to dull him during those last moments. And my own cousin, Reb Leib Lopian Zatzal, who was suffering the most terrible yisurim, the most terrible pain and suffering during the last months of his life, refused to take painkillers because they would dull his mind. And I didn't understand that at the time. Okay, dull your mind. So you've learned the whole of Shas, he knows, achieved a depth which very few people of our generation ever achieved. A lamdonus, an extent, so what, for the last few days, so you won't learn a little bit extra, what does it matter? What it matters is that if your mind is not operating to its full ability, you're always a human being, that's not a human being. What does the Sipurna say? Without that, you're nothing. Without that, there's nothing that lives on. That's what humanity is. That's what being a human being is. And rather live in the pain and the suffering with one's mind operating creatively than to live in physical comfort without one's mind operating properly. These are things that one needs to appreciate and to understand, that death is not something that needs to be left until the last minute. That's not what it's for. Death was created to be utilized throughout one's life, to use it throughout one's life. Not as a black threat, oh, black threat, and it's a terrible thing, and death, and what's going to become of me? Not that. just the knowledge that I don't go on forever, and that the one thing I don't know about is whether I'm going to be here in 5 minutes time, and the one thing I do know about is that I'm here now, and that's about all I can be sure of. Everything else is secondary. And once one has that understanding, one is able to utilize those moments of one's life, and hopefully very many moments of one's life, constructively and creatively, as a human being needs to utilize them, and as we would have utilized them had Adam not eaten from the Eitz HaDaas.